Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Coronavirus and Health System Capacity, Prescription Drugs and Vaccines. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. Today's call is part of a series between the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for Health Policy on health system capacity. Today, we'll focus specifically on the prescription drug supply chain, the progression of a COVID-19 vaccine, and the related infrastructure needs. We'll address what best practices can ensure the timely and safe production of a vaccine and federal and state health infrastructure needs required to maintain our momentum against this disease. We know the pandemic will touch every corner of our health system, but we only have a few minutes today, and we're going to be very focused on specific actions around the prescription drug and vaccine pipeline. We plan to address other health policy-related aspects of system capacity in upcoming calls. I'm joined today by experts Mark McClellan and Peggy Hamburg, both former FDA commissioners. Mark is a professor of business, medicine, and policy at Duke University's School of Business, and Peggy is the Foreign Secretary of the National Academy of Medicine. I'll start with Mark for his thoughts on strategies to expedite the development and evaluation of medical products, specifically prescription drugs and vaccines, to track, treat, and prevent the spread of COVID-19. And then we'll turn to Peggy. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Rachel, thanks very much, and thanks for all the Commonwealth Fund is doing, rapid response to the threats created by this epidemic. It's been great to see. I just finished a webinar with the Alliance for Health Policy on similar topics. I'm going to be very brief here. In terms of moving forward, a couple of things that are really important. One is getting past this surge, the point where our health systems are confidently not going to be stressed again to this level, because we're going to have cases better under control through steps like the social distancing measures. But to start to relax these intensive physical isolation measures, we really do need a national COVID-19 surveillance system that enables rapid testing and tracing of contacts, and much better ability to detect, smoke out, and contain outbreaks before they get large. We have, working with Scott Gottlieb and others, on a report on this topic that will be out shortly. The other key piece, of course, in the whole ballgame is how fast we can get effective treatments available. Good news is there are a lot of treatments that may work that are in some form of clinical testing and actual real-world use. They include antivirals, both antivirals that are on the market already, like hydroxychloroquine, and antivirals that are in development, like remdesivir at Regeneron, and many others. Also, immune response-related treatments, so-called convalescent serums, antibodies recovered from people who have recovered from COVID-19. Those are getting into more testing and emergency use as well, and then synthetic versions of those antibodies, ones that are kind of relatively new technologies to make it very large scale, antibodies that look like they'll be really effective against the virus. Those are in clinical testing now and plans for advanced manufacturing. As well, there are treatments for very severe cases wherein maybe an excessive immune response mediated through the IL-6 and leukin 6 system may be involved. These are complex sick patients, but some promising treatments to help with really severe cases and testing. Of course, this is ultimately going to be controlled when we have one or more safe and effective vaccines, and a lot of steps underway to accelerate their development. So I had a paper with Scott Gottlieb that's available on our Duke Margolis website that describes a set of steps that we think would help in accelerating these treatments. I just want to highlight a couple of points here. One is that this really is a sort of an all hands on deck moment where government support for funding from National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease and BARDA, the Biological Advanced Research and Development Authority for supporting countermeasures, can make and is making a difference in identifying and helping to fund the development of some of these compounds. There have been great steps, important steps from the biopharma, pharmaceutical industry to share information about potentially viable compounds and support getting the most promising ones into testing. That's all great. What people should be focused on now is how quickly and efficiently are effective clinical studies being conducted. So not just whether all these treatments are available, but how many of them are in reaching the stage of clinical studies and hopefully pivotal clinical trials to be used as a basis for approval. Are those trials well-designed? Are they adequately powered? I mean, enough people with enough data collection on the right questions to get to an answer as quickly as possible and certainly on schedule? And are we really ramping up our capacity to do that, just not on a one-off basis, but using common data models and common efficient approaches to designing and conducting these trials so that we can answer questions on as many of these drugs as quickly as possible, and steps toward building sort of platform trials and the capacity to test a range of compounds and rotate in new ones and rotate out ones that either don't work or proven effective is something that's in the process of taking place now, but I think could be accelerated further. The other thing that I really want to emphasize about evidence and access to treatments is, quite understandably, there is intense interest in the availability of treatments when there's even just a suggestion that they might work, like we've seen with hydroxychloroquine, resulting in shortages of that drug in some places, even as we haven't gotten as much clinical evidence as we'd like. And I think there are feasible ways to conduct clinical studies in more real-world settings. Some of them are underway now on hydroxychloroquine. We're going to need that capacity even more as additional treatments come to market with some evidence that they do work, at least in certain populations or certain uses, maybe prophylaxis, maybe more severe cases, but still very important questions about, well, who else might benefit and how do we use these treatments effectively in combination? So having real-world networks to develop that evidence and share it quickly is going to be increasingly important over the coming weeks so that we're not left with hoping for the best and maybe not prioritizing effectively the treatments that seem like they might work, but we're really getting to more definitive answers quickly about how best to treat each type of COVID-19 patient and really move the curve on the effectiveness of therapies and better outcomes for patients.
Mark, thank you so much. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Peggy.
Okay, well, thank you. And it's really a great privilege to be with my colleague, Mark, and also to be part of this Commonwealth Fund event. I know we have little time, so I will try to be brief. Mark gave just an excellent overview of the range of different kinds of medical products that are currently under development, really focusing on therapeutics for the moment. Of course, there are also, you know, huge research and development efforts underway with respect to diagnostics and vaccines. And for both of those categories of medical products, there are a number of different types being developed, and that is critical as well for diagnostics. We need the rapid point of care diagnostics that can give us answers quickly. We need the broader laboratory base that can handle volume of diagnostics that will tell us using the PCR capability whether someone is actually infected. And then we need the serology test, the test that can tell us whether someone has actually been infected, presumably cleared that virus and has developed immune protection of some kind with the development of antibodies against the virus, and that antibody testing will be very important over time in telling us both more about the sort of contours of this epidemic in communities and across the nation in terms of what's the background level of infection, since we're now learning that many people can be infected asymptomatic and not even have known it. And it will be also very important in helping to think about how to strategically and safely get people back into the workplace, whether they're healthcare workers or other first responders or just individuals that have some natural immune protection while we're waiting for a vaccine, and but we do need to get our economy going again. And then, of course, there are quite a number of vaccines, more than 50 different candidate vaccines fitting into, you know, some 7 or 8 different domains of vaccine type. So I think it is a very exciting time, but we have to ensure that the studies move forward so that we can get critical information about which of these different kinds of products being developed work and for whom, under what conditions, and that we get real answers. I want to underscore that as we think about how to do studies in more innovative ways, more rapidly, use different kinds of data, we still have to always have true scientific rigor, because we're not doing anybody any favors if we don't know whether the products actually work. And, you know, even when we are increasingly desperate for treatments and vaccines, we really do need to recognize that drugs that may seem promising early on working in a test tube or in animal studies don't work when they get into people. And the only way to know what will really benefit patients now and going forward is to do these studies. And that, you know, some people say, well, in a crisis, anything must be better than nothing. But that also isn't the case, because drugs have toxicities, vaccines can have safety issues, you can make someone worse off, and you can also prevent them from getting other treatments that might have benefited them. So with that, I also want to just touch briefly on one other important area that we're already grappling with to differing degrees, and that has to do with shortages. Shortages of medical products for routine but significant medical care needs, and of course shortages within the area of COVID-19 medical products. And, you know, on COVID-19, we've certainly been hearing and are very distressed to see the shortages that have existed with respect to diagnostic kits, with respect to the swabs and reagents necessary to do those tests, with respect to personal protective gear, and of course, ventilators. Also some of the medical drugs in New York City, some of the hospitals are experiencing shortages of propofol, an anesthesia drug necessary to help actually intubate someone so they can go on a ventilator. But then also concerns about routine medical needs. As many of you probably know, drugs that are used in this country come to a considerable degree in whole or in part from other countries. The active pharmaceutical ingredients and drugs we take here, for example, come largely from China and from India. There have been dislocations in supply chains in important ways. And while many companies have had some essential reserves so they can continue to manufacture, we have seen some concerns about these supply chains, and we may see more. China is getting back up and running, and that's good news, but with the lockdown in India, and they make a very large proportion of the generic drugs used in this country, and even though India has identified the pharmaceutical industry as an essential area of work, it's anticipated, or we should be prepared for the possibility that there may be shortages. So, you know, with everything swirling around, a few more things to be thinking about preparing for and hopefully being able to address before major problems emerge. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Peggy. I just wanted to remind everyone to ask a question. You can press star one. You'll be entered into the queue. Peggy, maybe while we're letting people queue up, I can just start with a quick question to you. And that was on your comments about manufacturing and the supply chain being so distributed across many countries. And if either of you or both of you have thoughts on, if you think once we get through the phases that Mark has laid out, past this current acute situation of COVID-19, do you think that we will be having conversations about, you know, reevaluating our manufacturing of drugs and supplies and the kind of the cross-national boundaries of this situation? Is this something that you think the U.S. will be thinking about and dealing with differently after this situation that we're in right now?
Yeah, well, that is such a crucial question, Rachel. And, you know, certainly there is a lot of thinking going on, and I hope that we will be able to work in collaborative ways with other countries in order to be able to provide critical products to people who need them wherever they are. But, of course, there are all of the issues around also serving the needs of our country. I work a lot now as Foreign Secretary for the National Academy of Medicine and as a board member of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, CEPI, that is supporting vaccine development against COVID-19. And also I serve on the board of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, which purchases and supplies vaccine for the poorest countries in the world. There's huge concern about whether should we have vaccines that prove to be safe and effective, and I think we all believe there will be, those vaccines are going to be needed in huge numbers. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine, and everyone is going to want it as quickly as possible. Right now, manufacturing capacity for vaccines in this country and around the world is limited, and we don't yet know which of the vaccine candidates are going to make it through the development pipeline to actually be needed for scale-up and manufacturing and availability. Hopefully, there'll be different candidates, but each one is going to require a different manufacturing capability as well. So we need to be thinking about manufacturing capability now. Gates Foundation actually just announced a few days ago that they're going to be putting billions of dollars into establishing multiple vaccine manufacturing capabilities to better prepare us for this anticipated reality, which is a marvelous and generous undertaking on their part and will position us better. But we also are going to need some kind of global governance mechanism, in my view, that will enable us to think about how to make vaccine available, especially in the early times when volumes are limited, in a way that is fair and reflects critical public health need and management of this unfolding epidemic, and doesn't just reflect who has the greatest resources to purchase vaccine. Because at the end of the day, our ability to control this vaccine depends on public health control and management first.
Yeah, just to add
a
couple of things on this important issue. On Peggy's point about vaccines, as she said, the big challenge is that if you wait till you prove a vaccine is safe and effective to really start manufacturing, it's going to be a while before the vaccine makes it everywhere it's needed, particularly more vulnerable low- and middle-income countries. So steps like Gates is taking and BARDA is taking and some of the manufacturers are taking now, which is for the promising vaccine candidates, you know, maybe there are 8 or 10 of them, we need to invest in pre-clearing the quality of that manufacturing capacity and in the capacity to deliver, you know, literally billions of doses. And what Gates has done, what BARDA has done, these are important steps. But, you know, this is tens of millions of dollars in investment that the planet really needs and the country really needs if we're going to get this epidemic under control. And it is going to take widespread access to vaccines. I do think the drug shortage issues are ones that we're not only going to be looking at in the future, but that people are looking at now. I think for the most part, most Americans shouldn't be worried right now about access to most of the drugs that they use. The supplies generally look good, and many insurers have encouraged people to get 90-day supplies of their drugs just because it's, you know, maybe hard to get out for a bit and just to keep everyone secure. The areas where we do have some issues are in drugs that turn out to potentially be useful in COVID-19. So we've seen what's happened with the hydroxychloroquine shortages, and hopefully we can address that, as Peggy said and we said, by getting better evidence on whether or not this treatment actually works and then ramping up. But other drugs that have been needed in the surge have been that are generic and don't have, you know, brand name manufacturers with well-developed and well-planned supply chains. You know, manufacturers of these generic drugs that are much more kind of on the edge in terms of keeping costs low and not having more significant margins. That's where more of the issues have come up. So for drugs like propofol and midazolam that are used for patients who are intubated, there are some real shortages there that we need to account for as we get through the surge now. Hopefully we won't see a surge again this big. If we do things right, we'll never see a surge again like this. But there are some steps that should be taken to maybe convert some domestic manufacturing capacity. There are a number of U.S. manufacturers of different kinds of generic drugs that could be converted, and FDA is working on, and BARDA are working on accelerating that kind of process. And then anticipating what may be in shortage later. So I know we've had big shortage issues with drug tests not having enough supply, and with the reagents and the swabs that go along with it. I think that's all going to get better. Many of the tests that are coming online now are being manufactured in much bigger capacity. Many of them, the point of care tests like from Abbott and Cepheid, come packaged with the reagents that are needed. And again, they've worked out supply chains that they think are going to be adequate for a big ramp up in supply. But still, swabs some of the other lab test materials are something we should be planning ahead to make sure we've got adequate supplies for as the use of testing really increases in the coming days and weeks.
Great. I'm going to turn it back over to our operator. I know we have a number of questions queued up, so.
And we'll take our first question from Armin Azad with CNN. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Armand's here from CNN. So my question is, you know, I know you all touched on kind of the need to be cautious, you know, moving forward with these drugs and doing the trials. And, you know, I know the FDA, you know, probably one of the hallmarks of the FDA is there are very specific decisions and steps, and there are emergency use authorizations versus FDA approval versus pre-market approval for diagnostics. And, you know, I know we've heard a lot about kind of the danger of, you know, moving too quickly. But I feel like, you know, maybe one of the elephants in the room is, you know, we have top official in this country, the president, talking about, you know, this drug has received FDA approval, hydroxychloroquine, and talked about, you know, this being a possible almost miracle cure. And I was wondering if, you know, from your perspective, being in charge of the agencies that have approved these types of drugs in the past, what is the danger of making claims like that when the evidence base just isn't there yet?
Well, I'll jump in first, I guess. I mean, I think it is very important to do the studies as quickly as possible, but to really be able to understand the appropriateness and value of a particular drug for a particular indication. Take hydroxychloroquine. It has been around for a while, many decades, in fact, and we we, you know, do know a considerable amount about it for the indications that it's approved for anti-malaria prophylaxis and management, and certain autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. It is a drug that has significant toxicities. So, you know, simply shifting it over to another area of treatment without doing the studies is of concern. So we know that in other instances, there can be major problems associated with assuming that a drug that may have some known value will be good for another indication. You know, thalidomide is sort of the classic case where it wasn't used in this country, but it was used in Europe for the management of morning sickness in pregnancy and some related symptomatology, and it ended up causing birth defects. So we need to take these things, you know, seriously. On the other hand, we all feel this sense of urgency to get answers, to get treatments to people who need them. And I think what Mark was speaking to in his opening remarks is that there are many ways to quickly do that robust scientific evaluation so that at the end of the day, we can actually benefit patients now and in the future.
Yeah, we just add to that that, you know, we totally understand how if you've got COVID-19 and especially if you've got serious complications and there's nothing that people are saying actually works, you want access to something. And so I totally appreciate that. It's also important to keep in mind, as Peggy says, that what we really want for the most people to have the most, the best outcomes from this pandemic is to learn as quickly as possible about what treatments can really help them. And it's challenging, but it's possible to do both if we pay attention. Number one, to have an emergency access program for these drugs, like is the case now for hydroxychloroquine, but also if we make sure that the public understands that there are these important unanswered questions and there are relatively rapid ways of answering those questions. Clinical studies that can be done in real-world settings. Again, some of them are underway now involving hydroxychloroquine and should have results in a matter of weeks. And as long as we're paying attention to both of these issues, both the importance of emergency access for people who have no other hope, but also the need to, in real-world settings where many of these treatments are going to either on the market or they're going to come to market with limited evidence of learning more fast, that's the best way to get through this epidemic. Just to say one more point about back to Peggy's discussion of diagnostic testing, this issue applies there too. So there are a number of tests for so-called serology of COVID-19 that tests for presence of antibodies in a sample of a person's blood. Those tests came to market to help with, not to be the only test available, but to help with diagnosing whether or not people have had a recent infection. They don't turn positive for a matter of days to a week, but they can help, and they're relatively easy to do from a small blood sample. The hope is that those can turn into, with more development and understanding about how good they are, tests that can be used to reliably determine whether someone's got immunity to COVID-19. But we aren't there yet, and these tests are on the market. So one more example of where we're going to need to do studies in the real-world setting to see if the tests really are reliable enough and can be improved enough to be good for understanding immunity. So this is just one more example of exactly what we're talking about. There are going to be a number of treatments that come to market with emergency use or with some evidence that they might work in some group of patients, but we have to find ways to learn quickly about additional evidence on safety and effectiveness so we can really fight this pandemic with knowledge.
And we do have a question from Meryl Gosner with Modern Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Thanks. To follow up, the FDA, under its emergency use authorization, did require that physicians who were prescribing hydroxychloroquine report results. Have either of you had a chance to review that form? I shared it with some people who are expert in design and clinical trials, and I got some feedback that said it was not adequate to really generate real-world evidence. I'm also pursuing with hospitals if anybody's actually filling out these forms. They've now been out there for a week. Can you enlighten me on, A, what you know about how this is being collected by the FDA, what they're doing with that information, and whether or not this is going to generate actionable data prior to the reporting of clinical trials, which people tell me are at least about 6 to 7 weeks away?
Well, collecting data is useful. I haven't actually seen the language in the EUA, but collecting data does not substitute for a controlled study. And so we need to continue to do controlled trials to be able to really answer the question of, does hydroxychloroquine work? And also, at what stage in disease does it work? I apologize, my phone is ringing in the background. And, you know, I think that it's wishful thinking, if I can be blunt, that, you know, simply putting the drug into the hands of physicians who care for these patients and asking them to report back, you know, doesn't substitute for controlled clinical trials, will not get us the meaningful answers that we want. And probably it's too much to ask in an overwhelmed healthcare setting like we now have to expect the reporting to be adequate, even though those physicians probably would want to be as helpful as possible.
Yeah. I do think there are some steps that can be taken to make it easier for clinicians who right now are overwhelmed, but hopefully as we get past the surge, we'll have a little bit more bandwidth for helping to learn from the experiences that they're having with their patients. There are so many questions we just don't know the answer to. This is such a heterogeneous disease with ranging from asymptomatic to death and you know, but to some extent in every subgroup of the population. What are the factors that influence that? What's kind of the baseline course for particular kinds of patients? There are lots of opportunities to get that kind of evidence from real-world data, from electronic records, from other data sources. And Peggy's right that the gold standard for knowing whether treatment works is to randomize people to get the treatment or not. That's going to be hard to do on a large scale in a lot of these real-world settings, but there are some examples of where that can be done, or maybe where people could be randomized to one treatment versus a different treatment, both of which are suspected to have some benefits, or maybe a difference in timing or dosing of a treatment. So lots of this work is starting to take place, and the more that the federal government working with healthcare payers and the clinical enterprise can support this, the faster we're going to actually be able to learn from all of this real-world experience that we're living through now with COVID-19. And I apologize, I have to go to another urgent call, but thank you all for the opportunity to join.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And we I'm still here. And I can answer a couple more questions if people are interested, and then I'll need to sign off as well.
We do have a question from Beth Wang with Insight Health Policy. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. As we're talking about getting data quickly and doing trials and making sure we have the right evidence while also collecting real-world evidence, I know there's been a lot of criticism about some of the studies on hydroxychloroquine that are being touted, but those are being heavily criticized for not having sort of enough people or not studying long enough. So I was wondering, from the perspective of what would be needed for FDA approval, what are some of the parameters, are the specific parameters that would make it, you know, make for a good study of this drug that could happen sort of quickly, and then that would need to happen in the long term, I guess, number of people that should be studied, placebo versus comparator drugs, things like that.
Well, I don't think we need to get into all of the complexities and specifics of clinical trial design. I think the important issue is that appropriate studies, in fact, are now underway to give us the kinds of really meaningful answers we need about hydroxychloroquine and its relative risks and benefits in patients with COVID-19. I do think, you know, one of the concerns about some of the studies that have been discussed to date is that they haven't really had the rigor in terms of following all the patients to the end, you know, patients that might not have been doing as well, might have been dropped off of the study. There haven't been, you know, the controls in terms of matching patients getting it at different times. So you end up with some information that's interesting, but it doesn't give you the conclusive information that you need. You don't have to do, you know, the perfect randomized controlled clinical trial. There's lots of opportunity for innovation, but it has to have scientific rigor. And I think the other thing that is exciting that's going on, and Mark mentioned it in passing, but I'll just bring it up now, is that some of the clinical trials that are now underway and being planned are trying to recognize this sense of urgency about trying to get drugs that may hold promise to patients as rapidly as possible. And so trying to do studies that have multiple arms against one control arm so that more people can get access to a candidate product while the studies are going forward. And I think that's also you know, very, very important as we're trying to balance this issue of getting access to drugs that may hold promise, but also getting the answers that actually will benefit patients over the longer term.
We'll now take a question from Jeannie Bowman with Bloomberg Law. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I was wondering, Dr. Hamburg, if you could comment on whether you thought the FDA's emergency use authorization to allow hydroxychloroquine into the strategic national stockpile was, you know, the right decision, or if you thought it was premature given everything you've said about the lack of clinical evidence at this point.
Well, I am concerned that we need to get those, you know, I'll say it again, robust scientific answers about whether this drug works for patients with COVID-19. And we need to make sure that by making the product available and collecting information from physicians and patients who've had it, that isn't taken as a substitute for the clinical studies. The clinical studies, you know, there are important clinical studies underway. They need to be continued. We need to get those answers. And that's really where I want to put my emphasis is the importance of really not creating false hope, not sending a message that over determines the benefits of any given product, and that we really make sure that we do the science, but we do it as effectively and efficiently as possible.
And we'll now go to Emily Kopp with CQ Roll Call. Please go ahead.
My understanding about the limited evidence about this drug is that it helps mitigate symptoms for people with mild cases. So I'm wondering if thinking about this drug as an option for people with no other hope is a correct frame for thinking about emergency use before these randomized clinical trials are complete.
Yeah, well, that you raise an important point because we're, you know, in the discussion speaking about the desperation that many people are feeling with respect to the more severe cases. Although one of the things that is striking about this COVID-19 disease as we learn more about it is that as Mark noted, there's this heterogeneity from those who are totally asymptomatic to those who have severe disease. And healthcare providers do report that sometimes a patient with you know, relatively moderate disease, you know, talking to you and feeling relatively good, can suddenly decompensate and have much more serious disease. So we want to take all of the individuals infected with COVID-19 seriously. We want to be able to offer products that will both ease symptoms, decrease the length of the disease course, and of course, treat acute life-threatening disease as well. So I think, you know, that, again, I come back to, I know it's, you know, it's like a broken record that we need to continue to advance these products. We need to study them, but we need to do it in ways that are innovative and responsive to the unfolding crisis of this novel coronavirus outbreak.
And at this time, I would now like to turn the program back over to our moderator, Rachel Newsom, for any closing remarks.
Great. Thank you all so much for joining us today. And another big thank you to Mark McClellan and Peggy Hamburg for just an excellent tour de force of thoughts around the supply chain and vaccines and infrastructure needs. We know you all are pressed for time, and we appreciate you being here with us today. If any of you had questions we didn't get to, please feel free to reach out to us by email. As I mentioned, this is being recorded. We will place the recording as well as all of the Commonwealth Fund's COVID-19 resources on our COVID-19 resource page. We look forward to speaking with you going forward, and we hope this was helpful. Thank you all once again. Stay home and stay safe.
Thank you.